This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hey friends, welcome to another week. Let's get to it. Guest we're having on today, total badass. He's a firefighter. He's got an incredible story. You won't even believe what happened to him on his first day as a firefighter. Unreal. Met him last year, not quite a year ago, in California. But he's not from California, he's from Virginia. He attended Elk Shape Camp, happened to win Spirit Elk Shape Camp Award, we'll get into it. And happened to get his first elk on the ground after camp this year, we'll get into it. Just a great story, great dude, and just shout out to all you firefighters. Now, speaking of shout outs, I want to give a shout out to Matthews. If you do want to build your own bow, I just got the new Title 36. Built that sucker on bowbuilder.com. Matthews has that feature where you can kind of handpick everything, and then you can send that PDF, email it, print it out, bring it to your local dealer. And the reason why I ordered a target bow is because I wanted to shoot one in the off season at paper. I just told myself if I didn't get it in time, I was going to not shoot paper, but shoot foam instead. And that's where I'm at. And I'm okay with that. But now I'm going to have to, there's no excuses now. We're going to have to see where we're at when it comes to, five spot, Vegas, things like that. We're going to shoot some paper, get this bow set up this week. We'll bring it to you all on the YouTube. Born Primitive Outdoors, they're asking me to make a quick reel for them about what do I use when I go spring bear hunting. And I think essentially they want me to break down their layering system, which is a good idea. Typically, your first level or next to skin is, it's got a job, and it's to draw the moisture away from your body, the moisture being sweat, and it's also to keep you dry while providing some sort of insulation, the end. Then you're going to get into your level two, which is more like your mid layer. And that layer is one that, as an archery elk hunter, a lot of times that layer's not even on. It's so damn hot, unless it's in mornings or evenings. But that mid layer is to just be versatile. It's another thermal layer, thermal protection. And then level three, this is all about that final, any climate type vibe. It's your best defense against getting cold. And then you have a level four, which would be water prevention, rain gear, hydrophobic type material. That's what you need to know when it comes to layering systems. And with Born Primitive, what I typically recommend people to do is for their base layers, a lot of guys like merino base layers, and that's cool. I typically just run synthetic or some sort of combination, but check out Born Primitive's quiver base layer. It's fully synthetic. That's going to be the sweet spot. But on the top layer, man, you can also do the top layer synthetic. That's what I do. But then I dive into a sun shirt, because a lot of the stuff I do, even in the spring, up at snowpack, the sun pops out midday, and then you're getting sun flare. Sun's beating you down and you're against snow at the snow line. I like the sun shirt from Born Primitive, almost like your second layer, to be honest with you. But go back, look at the synthetics. And if you are a merino dude, guess what? Check out the Ridgeline. They have a half zip hoodie. It's premium merino. Antimicrobial, obviously retains its insulation value when wet. They also have options if you don't want a quarter zip, you can just get a no zip, no hoodie. I do like the hood, to be honest with you. I prefer it. For the mid layer, I think most people are going to want to check out the Men's Quiver half zip hoodie, whatever color you want, or a full zip if you're into it. It will come with GridTech technology. It's going to help keep moisture drawn away from that level one base. And it's also, you can wear it by yourself, which I do quite a bit. Grid Tech fabric is 95% polyester, 5% nylon. Well, maybe we'll do a kind of a Spring Bear, like dedicated podcast and kind of run through gear long form, just so you guys can kind of hear more about systems. As the older I get and longer I've hunted, to me, it's more about refining these systems and figuring out what works, what doesn't, what makes sense, and what allows me to hunt hard and say semi-comfortable, but definitely be able to rely on my gear for performance and the pursuit and hopefully just getting a bear on the ground. You know, guys, last year, hate to remind myself this, but I didn't shoot a black bear last year. And that's the first time, and I don't even know how long. And it wasn't for a lack of trying, and it wasn't for a lack of effort, but I did have a couple decent opportunities that, looking back, I squandered, or I didn't realize that that was going to be my one and only go or whatever. But yeah, man, it was a tough bear hunting year for me. I even went to Canada and didn't kill a bear. But I'm also at the point in my life where I don't need to kill a bear. And I was certainly the pickiest I've ever been last year. And that's okay. But man, I do love being out there in the spring. There's no question. And it's about that time. And so I'm actually going to bust out my rifle this year, not on bears, but I'm going to bust it out because I'm going to be having some wolf tags in my pocket for sure, mountain lion tag. And a lot of those opportunities, I'm not going to try to stalk with a bow. I'm going to be like, oh my gosh, let's make this happen now. Let's save some elk. But let's dive into this pod. This is Carter Lewis. He is the man. Thank you for listening to the Elk Shade Podcast.
Yeah, that was a good one, man. Shout out to Chris Cook for hosting. Well, what have you been up to since that camp, man?
Really good turkey season that April. We went out and did 4 weeks or 3 weeks out west, hit Wyoming, South Dakota, Kansas, pretty much right after that. Killed four birds. That was a good time. Did some shed hunting. Then had a really good fall season. Got my first elk in Montana. Killed two muleys and one whitetail out west too. So it was awesome.
Yeah, dude. That makes me smile. What was it like walking up on your first elk?
I thought it'd be more like tore up, but I sort of had a couple minutes to calm down because after I shot mine, I watched it fall over like 30 yards, right? And then we spent another 30 minutes trying to call in. We called in four bulls at the same time. So we spent another 30 minutes trying to get my buddy to shoot another one. It took some time to calm down, but yeah, walking up to that thing and seeing how big it was pretty awesome. It was just a 3x3, but man, that thing was pretty incredible.
Was that your first time in Montana?
No, I hunted Montana two years before that in the spring. Went out, killed two gobblers in like the eastern side of the state. Then we went further west and did some spring bear hunting. But we got rained on and sleeted on every day, so it was pretty miserable. We saw a lot of bear signs, saw some grizz, but no black bears.
Sounds about right. Now, where's home base for you, Carter?
Virginia, like central Virginia. So I got to take the long trek out west every time I go.
How many hours is it for you to drive from windshield to windshield, mountain to mountain, Virginia to Montana?
It was 33.
Yeah, dude, that hurts, man. So I guess we got to back up and explain to the audience, like, you're pretty much, you have a cool story, and I want you to kind of dive in a little bit about what happened to you and how you responded, and then we'll kind of get into your hunting pedigree. I know you're a crazy turkey hunter, but kind of give us some backstory.
All right. I'm a firefighter in Virginia. Almost 6 years ago, it was actually my first day on the job. I just got hired, just finished recruit school, and we're working in Tropical Storm Michael, I believe was the name of it. And working on the side of the interstate, nothing serious, just a minor car wreck. And basically, as soon as we pulled up and as soon as I got out, track trailer hit us from behind, and it actually pushed the fire truck over top of my leg. That's what caused me to lose my leg. It really injured one of my good friends. He had a lot of internal injuries, traumatic brain injury. There was four of us on the truck, should back up. But the other guy, he managed to jump back in the last minute because of a lieutenant. He had time to look around and see it coming. And he pretty much sacrificed himself to make sure that Chris was able to jump back in the engine and give him good warning. But he ended up losing his life.
That's your first damn day as a firefighter. First day.
Yeah, first day paid on the street. I'd volunteered before that, but yeah, all worked out. I was able to come back. I was in the hospital for 3 to 4 weeks, I think, my first time around. I had a really bad knee injury too, on top of the amputation. So all my ligaments, my right knee, are replaced. So I really don't have full range of motion in my knee. I can bend to a 90, but I think a full, like, flexed out is, yeah, I can bend to a 90, but you really should be able to get a little bit more. And then I can't get perfectly straight. Like, I'm probably like 5 degrees short of getting straight. And then So had the couple weeks in the hospital, had to go back for an infection right where they had closed up the stump. Had to go back for another week. Nothing too serious, but just more stuff on top of that. But I was able to go back to work in a little bit over 7 months. I was back on the street.
You're a different breed, because I know there's a lot of people that would have been like, F this, I'm not being a firefighter, and y'all are going to pay me a lot of money to sit on my ass. And yet you, 7 months later, you're back on the job. What's wrong with you, man? And obviously I like what's wrong with you, but what's wrong with you?
So like we had talked about options and everything, obviously the first couple of weeks, but I had just turned 20 years old. There's no way I'm going to sit around or work some desk job in the fire department. Like that's not who I am. No desire to sit behind a desk, sit behind a computer all day or be, you know, retired essentially. So I wanted to keep on doing it. I'd already been volunteering for 3-4 years. I knew I loved the job and I just really didn't want to quit it at that point.
Yeah. What's your advice for those who, you know, want to be a firefighter? Of course, come to find out, Carter, you know, when I tried to be a firefighter, it's pretty damn hard. I put myself through a firefighter school out of my own pocket at a college. And then I volunteered like you did. And then I got turned down on a lot of interviews and I finally got hired and I did it for 2 years. I just had a podcast with the chief not too long ago, 6 months ago in Spokane Valley, which is honestly one of the best fire departments you could ever dream to work for. And a chief who's a freaking bow hunting elk hunter. He comes on my pod to recruit people. And they're just not getting enough people to apply and they're not getting enough people to make it through just a freaking academy, which is a walk in the park, in my opinion. What happened? I mean, because I'm sure when you got hired, I mean, look at it. You volunteered for 4 years with no pay.
Yeah, no, I don't really know what happened. When I applied, I think we applied for 12 positions were available. And there was like 360 of us in the test room. So it definitely helped those of us who had volunteered. It was almost like an internship unofficially for our department. So that definitely gave us preference. Yeah, I don't really know. Nowadays, I got some friends sit on the interview panel and help with the hiring process. We'll have like 20 positions and only get 50 applicants, maybe. You know how that is. I mean, some of them show up and they're late or they don't care. You know, they're just showing up to try real half-assed like. So, and then you end up with a very limited pool after that. So you might only have 18 people you could theoretically hire for 20 spots. So you're not really getting the best in those pools. And that's sort of shown its face here recently in the past couple of years, unfortunately. So I don't know why people are shying away from public safety. It's sort of the same thing. Some of my buddies who are cops and stuff like that, it's hard for them.
What a great job. That's my backup. My fail-proof plan is if elk shape goes away, I'm going to go back to be a firefighter. I love the guys and gals. I love the team. I love the work. I don't like the interrupted sleep, but there's just too many pros, few cons. And you guys see some pretty effed up stuff that it's probably unshakable, but it just blows my mind that your first paid day, you pull up to a basic, you know, traffic incident and get waylaid and somebody loses their life. How have you dealt with that, man? How long ago was that? And how do you deal with that? Like, that's just traumatic, right?
It's coming up on 6 years in October. But I really dealt with it just talking to some of the good mentors already in the fire department, just because I've been around the department volunteering. Stayed really close to them, was able to really talk with them, and just the brotherhood really helped. I had people reach out from all over the country, talk to me, and a lot of my friends from high school, we all volunteered together. So we really had that close, like really good network that I could fall back and rely on. So honestly, that's probably what helped get me through it. Just being able to have all those guys like right there with me helps a lot.
Yeah. Now, if memory serves me correct, at that camp last year in California, by day three, we did the workout at that cool little gym out in the middle of nowhere. And there you are, busting out the workout, hustling on one leg, basically on one full leg. And you won Spirit of the Oak-Shaped Camp, I believe.
Yep.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, that was a cool little gym.
That was a cool gym, man. So like, tell us about your training, how you've mitigated, you know, losing at the knee, one of your legs, and how you stay fit. And most importantly, how the hell you chase bugles in the Montana mountains on one leg, essentially.
Oh yeah. No, honestly, like the first, I'd say 2 years, I didn't take my fitness as seriously as I should have. You know, I was stubborn, didn't listen to my physical therapist, you know, telling me I needed to work out a bunch, but I definitely came to learn, like, I gotta keep in really good shape just to compensate so much. They say amputees, like they walk, we use 16 to 40% more energy than a normal person. So I got to crush that out of somewhere. So basically I started working out just a regular local gym here, Gold's Gym. I go every day, do a 3-split routine. And then recently, the past year, one of my lieutenants about a year ago, he was a big CrossFit guy. So I started going to his CrossFit gym, which is like 10 minutes down the street from our firehouse, which is really nice because we got to go on duty. Like you get paid to work out for an hour, 30 minutes a day. You can't beat that. Go on my days off. So that's really helped. Some of the things that are weird at first was like doing deadlifts and then doing squats. Just cause, really not because of the amputation, but because like the knee pain and the difference in mobility there. But honestly, now I don't really even worry about it. Gotten to the point where I'm just used to it. So I do definitely focus on a lot of leg stuff, leg strengthening, especially for the mountains. And obviously, Western hunting, a little bit harder. So that's, yeah, dude, just doing CrossFit's definitely helped the past year. That helped me get ready for those bugles. Because where I killed that bull was not an easy spot. We gained about 1,200 feet of elevation, about a mile, and then dropped about 800 feet down to where those bulls were. So then the pack out. It took us 2 days. A good buddy of mine moved to Helena about a year and a half ago. I was like, thank you. Got a place to stay. But he was with me. He had elk hunted one time before this in Colorado. So he knew a little bit more than I did. And just, yeah, the two of us took about 2 days to get out of there. And that was, as far as like hurting my leg and stump, that definitely took a toll on it. Some things I didn't really even think about till I got to mountains like that. If I'm side hilling and my left leg is downhill, it puts a ton of stress on my ankle. I guess just because my ankle's sort of worn out to begin with, but it like burns. So that was something I sort of learned. And something that actually really helped fix that was I would take my gaiters. I have the Crispy Idahos, so get a little bit more ankle support on that boot. And then I take my gaiters and cinch them super tight and it almost braces it. So that helps a lot. But my stump, there really wasn't nothing I could do. I had like a 1.5-inch blister coming off the tip of that thing by the end of day two, like all red and pussy and like it. Yeah. So like next year when I go elk hunting, I'm going to bring crutches. Hopefully for after the pack out, when I drive home, I'm just going to crutch when I have to go to the gas station and stuff. That was pretty rough, but it was that type two kind of fun where I can't wait to do it again.
Dude. So Carter, like for me as a 42-year-old guy, I use sissy sticks more than people would probably guess. Like, when I'm elk hunting, I usually have a trekking pole in one hand, a bow in the other. If it's not legal hunting hours, I might have my bow attached to my backpack and double trekkers. And I've done that because I just, you know, I'm out there for a month straight and I will take zero breaks, 0 days off. And so it's, to me, it's kind of like a marathon. I feel like that's added longevity. Are you using trekking poles at all?
Oh yeah. Not so much like when I'm walking into places, depending how steep it is. But yeah, when I was packing out, I was crutched on those things hard. Yeah, I think I went up on the pack out. I had the head and I want to say a back quarter and then both back straps was my first loadout.
Damn.
So I definitely had those trekking poles in full gear. And then my buddy Troy was a total G and he actually carried my bow because I had the head on the back of my backpack. So I couldn't really get it situated to where I thought it was going to stay. So he actually carried my bow in one hand and then loaded his bow on the back of his pack and loaded the meat. So that was huge help. Otherwise, I was just going to leave my bow back there until the next day just because the head was all in the way.
Yeah, man. So you didn't cut the skull plate off. You took the whole head out?
Yeah. Yeah. I think next year I'm definitely going to pack a little saw just to cut the skull plate, especially if it's not something I'm going to mount. Because I spent a lot of time sitting there, you know, pulling the tongue out, pulling the eyes out. I was trying to get all the weight I could off that thing. But I think I'll bring a little saw next time.
Yeah. And what's interesting, man, for us out-of-staters, even though I live in Washington State, I only elk hunt in Washington when I have to. And, you know, so like there's all these, dude, this is crazy. Like, I don't even know if you know this, but you probably do. But like, it is absolutely almost impossible to know every state's rules and regulations about taking a head from one state to your state, crossing state lines with meat that is attached to a bone versus deboned, brain matter, a whole head, stuff like that. Have you looked into that at all?
Yeah. So I definitely knew like I can't have like Virginia, like, oh God, if I brought brain matter back from out of state, they'd be all over me. So a buddy of mine in Nebraska, he has a drill bit that almost, it's got like weed eater strings sticking out of it, like in four different ways. And so I carried one of those with me and you stick it in the back of the head and actually just basically mush all the brain and take a hose to it and wash the brain out. And they say that's good enough to not have the authorities all over you. But yeah, I didn't. I know some of them are weird with shoulders and stuff. I actually had that elk processed there in Helena.
Nice.
So it was all just packaged and everything, so I could take it home. And actually, so what I did was I left all the meat and everything at my buddy's house. I left my truck there too and flew home.
Okay.
And that way all my stuff was there because I still had a mule deer tag in Montana, and I flew back in November to get my muley. So that worked out
really
nice.
Okay. Because you got the mule deer elk combo in Montana.
Yep.
Okay. That makes sense. I mean, Montana's pretty intimidating. So like your buddy who lives in Helena, he just moved there, or was he like a resident there?
He just moved there. Me and him grew up hunting together in Virginia since we were like 12 or 13 years old.
Okay. That's what I thought. So realistically, you guys were both noobs. Did he do some scouting on your guys' behalf? Or was it like, man, let's throw a dart at the map and let's just cover country?
Yeah, he did some scouting, and he actually hunted, I got out there and started hunting on the 12th of September. So he did a little bit of scouting and hunted like one weekend before that. And when I got up there, it was during the middle of the week, so he had to work. So I had like 4 days basically to, the plan was I was going to try to find some elk, and then he'd help me that weekend. And the first place I went to, man, I pulled up to the trailhead, and on X and everything, that place looked money, looked good. He's scouting it. I've been looking at it for months. Well, I think everybody else has been looking at it for months because there was like 8 pickup trucks there.
Oh, yeah.
North Carolina, Wisconsin, everything else. And I went in there that evening and hiked up to a spot where I thought I could sort of glass down in some drainages. And I literally had 2 pairs of guys walk 80 yards behind me just hooting and hollering. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to unass this place. I just had a bad feeling about it. Saw a ton of trucks driving in there. I saw horse trailers over the place. I was like, I think I can try to find somewhere else.
Right.
So I had some backup plans, and on the way to one of my backup plans that night, actually, I was driving and I was just looking on Onyx. I had it on my CarPlay. And I was like, this little small piece of public right here, it's like nestled in between these mountains and surrounded by private. And I actually saw a pickup truck drive out that road with a huge bull on the back of it. And I was like,
oh God.
I was like, okay, let me go look at this. So I go in there, and it's one of those BMAs, the piece of public, you know, Montana, yeah. You sign in or whatever. So I get up in there that night, camp, wake up in the morning, walk in there. And I'm like, this doesn't look like elk country, but I mean, I've seen videos where people are killing them in places like this. And I saw that truck. And like that morning, I saw 2 other trucks drive into some piece of private. They're obviously hunting. I was like, I just got to try this. Get up in there. And I'm sitting, it's like a big basin. And it's basically just rolling hills, really open, sporadic, like timber. And there's like timber on the hills, like in big strips, but it's pretty open for the most part. I'm sitting there and I'm actually glassing some muleys because there's like a decent little buck over there. I was just looking. I'd bugled a couple of times. And I look up on the hillside right across from me. I just see this big yellow thing. I know what that is. And it was like it was a decent branch antlered bull, essentially. Sitting there on this little lookout, just staring right at me. Because I'd made a new mistake. I was sitting on the side of this basin on a ridge, and all I had for cover was like a little pine tree next to me. I was partially skylined. Like I fucked up.
Yeah.
And he was looking right at me. He didn't really spook, but he definitely stared for like 5 minutes, then turned around and walked back in the woods. But I still ran over there and tried to cut him off where I thought he'd went. The wind was good, and I set up for like 45 minutes, did a couple like little calf calls. Later in that calling sequence, I bugled like once, just like a little roundup bugle, but he never came back out. And then the next morning was when my buddy Troy could come hunt with me. I told him, I was like, man, I saw a bull in here. I guess we'll go back in there. I saw some elk sign. And when we got back in there, and first thing in the morning, heard a bull on the private. He had a bunch of cows with him. And we basically played cat and mouse with him along the fence for 4 hours. We called his cows up to the fence. We called a spike up to the fence, but they knew what that fence meant, and they knew if they jumped it, they were in trouble. So never could get them to cross.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Went back in there that evening, same thing, played cat and mouse with them. There was a lot of bulls around there. Like, I mean, we heard bugles pretty much every direction. Just that one bull was the closest to the fence. He was basically just over a hill and like looking on Onyx. We couldn't really see what was over there, but looked like a bunch of water, a lot of greenery, a lot of timber. Like he was pretty safe and secluded, and he'd have to walk across some openings and get to us. And I figured it just wasn't going to happen. So again, the next morning, go back in there, mess with him. That evening, go back in there, and we actually went up to a glassing knob in that public and are looking back at the mountains. Like that bull is literally 300 yards behind us, just bugling every 5 minutes.
No.
It's nothing we can do. Like he ain't playing.
I call those the strip club bulls. I've said it before on this podcast, but man, like you can look, but you cannot touch. It is like, oh, it's the Onyx game. I kind of hate that game, to be honest with you, man. Like it's nerve wracking, even getting elked across fences without a decoy or some sort of visual confirmation. The deck stacked against you when you're in that particular position. And it's crazy how well these elk figure out where the safe places are. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. The cows and spikes literally walked to the fence. Like my tag was good for, in that unit, a cow, spike, bull, whatever. So
yep.
The first thing that jumped that fence was going to get an arrow shot at it. But they would walk right to it and nothing. So maybe a decoy would have helped. I don't know. It was frustrating for sure. And then I knew that land was leased out because I saw an outfitter on the other side of it driving in there. I was hoping like maybe they would bump them at one point, but they never even hunted that side of the ranch.
Oh, really?
So yeah, they're chasing elk somewhere else. It's all like little pockets of timber and there's elk in every little pocket. But yeah, so we just sat there and we started glassing the mountains. And sure enough, we saw like 12 or 15 elk walk out of the national forest onto private. And one was a really nice bull. At least I think it was a nice bull. Nice tines. Looked like a 5x5, but like pretty long tines. And he was out there just chasing some cows. A couple little raghorns were with him and some spikes. And me and Troy were like, man, we should go with them tomorrow. We looked at Onyx, and they were only like 200 yards from the public land. And they had walked out of the public land. Like that's where they were bedding, and they were walking into open, like private. So we went back to the truck and basically just tried to figure out how to get to them. The only way to get to them, of course, was to drive about an hour around. They're about 5 miles from us when we were glassing. But we had to drive about an hour around, park, and then the only way to get to them was to go up a mountain and down. So we the next morning, we still went back into the same place we were hunting because I wanted to wait. I knew if we were going to crest a mountain and go down into their bedding area, we needed to wait for the thermals to switch. Because otherwise, we're just wasting our time. We're going to blow them out of there. We went back in there, hunted until like 8:30, same thing, played with that bull on the fence, and left in about, we got back over to the other place, started hiking in, and we got to the top of the mountain at like 12:30-ish, and thermals were good, they were rising obviously at that point. Sat down, ate a lunch, snacked, just took a chill pill because we had to walk across a bunch of shale fields and scree fields and all that kind of stuff, so it was sort of a pain in the ass. And as we're sitting there, we just hear the nastiest bugle I'd heard that trip just ripped from below us. And I was like, all right, we're good. Like he's sitting down there just bedded and bugling off his cows or whatever. Grab our stuff. And we only lost like 700 feet of elevation, something like that.
Okay.
And maybe half a mile. So it wasn't terrible. Go down there, head across another big boulder field. And we get down to like this flat looking bench area, and we could see like there was a pond down there, and there turned out there was a bunch of ponds and like wallows that you couldn't see from Onyx, and Onyx didn't show there was any water there.
Okay.
And we're sitting there sort of on like a ridge. I guess we almost got to the bench. We're on a hill a little bit, like above the bench. And Troy's like, I'm just going to cow call real quick and see what happens. And dude, we were 150 yards from the whole herd. Like four bugles just ripped as soon as he did that.
Sweet.
Like right on top of us. So I'm literally like taking my release out, and I already hear like a hoof knock a rock. So I'm trying to get down this little hill to the bench, and I got halfway down that hill, and I already see like a tine coming through the woods. So I had to stop, and I was standing in the middle of just the open. No trees behind me, no bushes in front of me, just standing there with my bow and watching this bull walk towards me. And the whole time, there's four or five other bulls within 200 yards of me, and just I think they're still bedded down, really. bugling. And at that point, Troy behind me started doing some challenge bugles and Ray King trying to get him really riled up. And this bull, he walks to like 60 yards and just stops because he's on the bench and I'm sort of on the hill. Like to the bottom of the hill was 30 yards. I had enough time to range really quick. He stops and starts walking towards me. He's got a tree in front of him. Can't really see me. He's walking to the little opening I had at like 34 yards. So I draw back. He makes that opening. But like the way the hill crested down and the way that opening was, all I could see when he turned and came broadside was like the top 8 inches of his back and his whole neck and head. And he stopped and just looked at me. Full draw, just sitting there looking at me. And it had to be 2 minutes. I mean, had to be.
Yeah.
Sitting there starting to shake. I even like started letting the bow down, like pointing down towards my feet and just looking at me. He wasn't like freaking out, but he was just looking. And finally, he turned his head and like nibbled on something. And I let my bow down. Of course, I was in the open, no backstop. He jumped when I did that and ran like 15 yards. I was like, man, it's all over. But Troy was like 50 yards behind me. He saw that, let out a bugle, and then let out a few cow calls. And that bull did the same thing. Walked, turned, came behind the same tree, stopped. I drew again. He didn't move. Started eating on something. So I let down. Then I saw him walking again. He came out the same opening, but this time he was maybe only like 2 or 3 yards further back. It was back enough to where the hill and like where the hill crested was only covering his heart.
Okay.
So I actually had vitals that time. And since I was above him shooting down, I knew like shooting from my exit, it would come out low long. Like I hit high long and it would come out low long. That's what I tried to do. I basically aimed a little bit above the line of where his heart would be, let that arrow go right over the crest of the hill. It went in high. It didn't go all the way through. It hit a rib on the other side. But as soon as it hit him, he ran. And then Troy did perfect and bugled as soon as I hit him. He ran, stopped, looked back at me. And I was actually notching another arrow because he's only at 60 yards. I'm going to try to shoot him again. And looked back, looked forward, got dizzy, fell over, rolled down the mountain dead.
Okay.
Just perfect. And then I was about to do the whole, you know, jump up and yell. And I was like, still got like 4 bulls here. Let's try to kill another one. So I called Troy over and me and him switched spots. And he actually managed to get down to that bench. And I started calling for him. And at that point, like you could hear the bulls raking. You could hear them just nasty bugling. Like they were all mad. They thought we were another bull coming in and chasing their cows off. And so I started getting in that calling session with them. And after a while, they just weren't coming in. So Troy tried to go ninja mode and sneak into the one bull, the closest one to us. And he saw it. He got within 60 yards. I was sitting there just breaking a tree. He had 2 spikes with it. He was like, he told me he was right at 60 yards. I couldn't see him. I was probably 100 yards behind him at that point, maybe a little bit further.
Right.
But yeah, so he got in there and it caught him moving around a tree like at the last minute. Like Troy could have shot him probably at 60 or 50 yards. He just had to get that right shooting lane, but it busted him, ran off. The other bulls were still there. Troy came back to me and he was like, man, let's just take care of your bull. We got enough work cut out for us. I was like, no, man, this is a future problem for us if we kill two. Let's just try to get this done with.
I like that. But, okay.
But he was good at getting the one. So we just started working on mine and we spent the whole time breaking mine down, listening to the other bulls who didn't spook, just bugle for the next like 30, 40 minutes till maybe the wind changed or something and they shut up. Yeah, it was pretty awesome how that went down. I think a lot of dumb luck into that, but it was pretty sweet.
So what was your takeaways at Elk Shape Camp that you applied to this hunt? I mean, we're not doing Elk Shape Camps this year, but we are doing one elk immersion, which is kind of a hybrid. It's kind of an archery camp, also archery elk hunting. But you went to camp and then you killed an elk this year. Could be causation, could be correlation, could be, like you said, dumb luck. But like maybe for people that came that are listening that maybe want to lean into, what did you learn at that camp that actually you applied?
Joel Turner's stuff helped a lot. I honestly didn't even know who that was until the camp. So after that, research what he does, looked at the notes I took in camp, and I applied that to my shooting a lot. That definitely helped after drawing back on that bull 3 times and holding for so long, like keeping my shit together. And still when that finally I could shoot, squeezing, focusing, and making sure that arrow flew true. A lot of his calling stuff helped a little bit too. Like I've applied the calf stuff a lot.
Yeah.
And we didn't call a bull in with that, but it definitely kept the attention of that bull over on the fence. And it called his cows and his spike up to the fence a couple times. So that definitely helped. Yeah. And then that workout where we did those drills, running up the hill, then stopping, holding for a minute, and then shooting. I think in camp I missed like 2 out of 3 of those shots. So I actually practice that a lot at home, like probably like 3-4 times a week. You know, I do a little circuit or something, get my heart rate up, and then apply trying to shoot right after that. And no doubt that helped, because like I said, when that elk came in, I had to run down that hill, get in position, you know, already tired from that hike. And then I had my first elk coming walking in my face. So I was all jacked up.
What? You were t-shirt and sandals with flat ground in your backyard? Like what? Yeah. So like what kind of circuits were you doing, man? Like I want to dig in on that a little bit, because I do think like at some point in the summer, you got to kind of dedicate at least a shooting session to some stress of some sorts, and maybe or physicality. So like, what does your circuit look like? Or what was your favorite circuit?
My favorite thing just to do here at home, because I don't really have too much, is I would drag like a kayak or something really quick. I got a bunch of kayaks in my house because I fish a bunch. Drag that almost like a sled pull. And then I'd really just run around, do like a 30-40 meter sprint. Do that a couple times, come back, do a farmer's carry with some dumbbells that I had here. And then if I felt really froggy that day, I'd do some burpees on top of that just to really get jacked up before I started trying to shoot.
No, that's cool. I like the leg stuff, especially just cause I mean, we're not doing burpees when we're elk hunting, but we are like have a lot of blood in our legs. They're heavy. The heart rate's pounding. I'm into that for sure. And to be honest with you, man, like doing 25 camps in 5 years, the shooting under duress definitely always is eye opening for the participants. I've only had one guy who like just absolutely blew my mind. And that was in Arizona last year. God, what's his name? I think he's from Iowa, but he went to this Arizona camp. And at that camp, we had an outdoor shooting range. So Carter, we were doing like 70, 80 yard down and back sprints. We had step ups and it was, you know, 3 arrows and they were all longer shots than normal, like 50 yards, just because that's how it went down. That's how it worked. And the dude literally put 3 in the bullseye and had turned up a really fast time. And I was like, I remember asking, I'm like, who are you? Like, what are you, a competitive archer? Or like, what is your deal? But other than him, everybody else is just maybe lucky to even hit the target, if we're being honest.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I know. That's cool. And then Joel Turner's stuff is pretty powerful. He's the only guy I've ever really heard lecture about that angle of humanizing the elk hunting experience. Whereas like when, like I just use myself for example, like if I were to drink and get obliterated, intoxicated, whatever you want to call it, like I'm going to go total primal mode. And what I mean by that is just like your human instincts kind of kick in where, you know, you have very little filters, if you will. And you either want to, maybe some people when they drink, they want to either fight or do the other thing. And that's about it. And elk are very primal in the rut to where it's like, I'm here to breed as many cows as possible. And I'm going to fight you for the honor to do that. His whole analogy of like two guys fighting, like how to pick a fight with a guy in the bar is to not talk any crap to him, but to start talking to his girl. And you talk to his girl. You force his hand, right?
Yep.
And when you force his hand, he may try to intimidate you. He may like say, hey, let's go out in the parking lot. He may take a shirt off or kick a garbage can and kind of like that's his version of raking or displaying. And it's a lot of talk usually, but eventually it'll lead to a fight. And it all started because you were talking to his girl. And yep. I can see that working quite often for people hunting is to forget don't talk smack to the bull, talk to his girls. And if you don't know how to do that, you need to learn how to do that. And I think that does have, I don't know, Joel always texts me every year, man, always with an exact number of bulls he's called in for himself or other people without fail.
And like, yeah, I've seen his reels. It's pretty impressive. He'd be like, oh, just number 28 for the day.
Okay. So I didn't know he put that on social, but that's funny. I love that about Joel. Like he's here for it. Like his version of elk hunting is different than mine. Like me, I'll do whatever. If it means sneaking in, that's great. I'm doing that. That's probably what I do more than anything. But for him, that's never an option. It's I want to play the game. I want to call elk in. And you, as a turkey hunter, you probably want to play the game more than just sneak around. Am I wrong? Am I right?
Yeah, I do like the vocalizations and the similarities between turkey hunting and elk hunting is sort of what interests me at first. Obviously, it's totally different. I'm not going to let anybody say it's the same. But I do want to experience that, like sneaking in on a bull, either bedded or at a watering hole or something, sort of like you talked about.
Yeah.
I feel like it's almost can be more impressive in a way because you're able to sneak in undetected, really think about a game plan getting in there. But still, like listening to those bugles and them coming in charging like they did that day was the shit on any turkey hunt I've ever been on.
No, that's cool. I like that. And man, I mean, for all your years of turkey hunting, obviously you're pretty into it. Let's allow you the opportunity to compare and contrast turkey hunting from elk hunting from someone like you who's definitely like traveling state to state to hunt turkeys all over the world. Where are they different? Where are they the same?
I guess the same as far as like the locating aspect of it. So obviously you're listening for those bugles, you're listening for those gobbles. But I feel like that's sort of where it ends. Obviously you got like the setup of a turkey, you know, you call it in. I've only killed one turkey with a bow. I like doing it with a shotgun just because you can more run and gun. I feel like it's pretty tough to try to draw on a turkey in the open woods. Like it ain't going to happen. You got to be in a blind, and I'd rather be running and gunning.
Yeah.
So like that's sort of where it ends. And also like you're not challenging a turkey to fight. I don't use a gobble call. I never try to sound like a tom. I know those guys out there that do that, but you're always trying to play the sexy lady and draw them in. Where if
right.
you're an elk, you're elk hunting, you're out there with a stick in your hand, like you were that day, slamming against a tree, trying to sound like you're raking, and then getting on a tube and screaming at them. Like, I don't know. There's a huge difference when it comes to that. I feel like just the calling aspect of it. And then you got the country itself, like flatland Virginia turkey hunting. Any fat old redneck can do it. And there's plenty of them out here that do it. You can sometimes do it 200 yards from the truck. That doesn't exactly happen when you're elk hunting.
Right.
One of my more fun turkey hunts when I did Wyoming, we were in the mountains and we were racing up and down these mountains chasing these birds. And it was pretty comparable to like the kind of terrain I killed my elk in. So like that,
okay.
That sort of bridged the gap, made it similar in that way. But I guess that's sort of where like the similarities end, honestly. Even the e-scouting for turkeys, I feel like, is different than elk. It's almost not as – it's not as easy for sure because they can just pretty much be anywhere. Where elk
are looking
for more of these certain key things. Turkeys you can find in the backyard of some neighborhood.
Well, the cool thing is like you turkey hunted first, so you probably were pretty familiar with diaphragm calls. Am I wrong?
Actually, yeah, I suck at a turkey diaphragm. Like I am not the guy. I am there for slate call all day long. I can do whatever little cute little sexy sound you want on a slate. You give me a diaphragm, it's going to sound like a duck. It's not good. The elk diaphragms I was pretty okay with, I thought. It was easier to me than the turkey diaphragms. Totally weird, but yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a different stretch of latex for sure. When it comes to calling you and your partner, were you guys more like divide and conquer? Or were you more like, hey, your shooter for this day, I'll shoot it for the next day? Like, how did that work?
We honestly didn't even talk about it. I guess we're just so wrapped up in elk hunting for the first time. We didn't even talk about it. And when we heard that bugle, Troy pointed at me. He was like, get in your spot. I was like, oh, I guess I'm shooting today. So I think I definitely need to have that conversation in the future. I like the idea of doing the day-to-day stuff, like if you're partnered with somebody. I've done that before, obviously, with turkeys and deer and stuff. Or when me and Troy bear hunted in Montana before, the rule was whoever spotted it, like so whoever glassed it up got to hunt it that day. So.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't think a lot of people think about that before they head out. Like everyone's full of stoke and just wants to get out there. But then it's like, okay, how do you decipher, like what's the best team dynamic? And then just kind of having those conversations beforehand generally, you know, is a good idea. You know, for me, I've always been hunting solo for the most part. And when I seem to hunt with people, I'm the caller, you know, through and through or whatever. And, I like calling. It's cool to be able to manipulate an elk and get him to come in and I don't know, in direct traffic. But I do want to say, like, the last thing I would want is to hunt with someone who didn't know how to call and couldn't reciprocate, not because of lack of effort, but because of lack of practice and skill. So if you are that guy and you are someone's hunting partner and they're better than you, you have 5.5 months right now to step your game up. And when you're going to do that is in your vehicle, driving to and from work, or probably not in the morning before the family wakes up, and probably not late at night when the family goes to bed. But, you know, having a tote with your elk calls and you only bust those out as you're packing for your elk hunt, I think that might be a recipe for disaster, you know?
Yeah.
How often do you practice?
Leading up to that, I was practicing from like, from the day camp ended till the whole drive to Montana. I had 33 hours of practice. So, okay. Yeah, I was practicing quite a bit. Troy is definitely, he's better. He was definitely the better elk caller. He had elk hunted in Colorado 3 or 4 years before that with his uncle and actually had called in a bull. So he had more experience, but he was definitely a little bit better than me, but I was able to hold my own. Like after I killed my bull and he went to try to get the other one, I took over calling. I felt like I did a pretty good job. I have probably like 10 minutes of audio from that, because I got the marsupial albino harness. Yeah. I took my phone and put it on video and slid it in their front pouch.
Okay.
I was hoping one of those bulls would come in and I'd see it. But so I got all the audio from that and I listened back to it. And I mean, they responded to everything I sent out, and some things were maybe going to tick more than others. And so, but I think definitely in the future, me and him will probably either do the day by day thing or, you know, whoever glasses it up first kind of deal. It was nice later in that season when I went back to mule deer hunt. I went solo and I killed my buck on day two. And luckily he got off like the next day and I had seen like 3 more bucks in that area. So I felt good. I was able to get him back in there and he killed his first mule deer buck the next morning in that same spot. So that was definitely pretty cool.
That's insane. Well, let's kind of shift this conversation to like these takeaways for maybe the folks listening that are in a similar position. They're looking at 33 hours to the nearest trailhead. And it's intimidating for sure, but it's also exciting. And what are some of your biggest mistakes you've made as an Eastern hunter coming out West?
See, my biggest mistake was I've learned this over turkey hunting and did like some antelope stuff. And then obviously this elk hunt too, is when I'm on Onyx looking at stuff, the juiciest thing I see that looks the best, I'm now getting to the point, like planning for next year, like I don't even drop a pin there. Cause I'm like, everybody else is looking at this same shit. Like every other person who's taken a YouTube class, like they see this and they're like, oh, you know, this is where they're all going to be. Well, that's also where 10 trucks are going to be at the trailhead. Where I killed that bull was really out of the way. It wasn't that far from the trailhead. We're only like 1.5 miles, but like the obstacles to get to it was what made it tough. So now I've been sort of looking for stuff like that where it might not be the furthest from the trailhead, but it's either a pain in the ass to get to, or you got to play that private public game. So like that was probably my biggest learning curve. And I actually used that a lot that last spring turkey hunting. You know, everybody wanted to go back to the deep section of national forest land. And I actually killed one of my birds like off the side of a cliff with only a 300-yard buffer to the private piece. Just trying to think outside the box was my biggest takeaway.
Yeah, I like that, man. Let's brainstorm. Like, what is pain in the ass? Obviously, number one, in my opinion, is elevation or a body of water, i.e. a river, something to where kind of cock blocks your access. And when you get into the country, it could also be just downfall hell. And yeah. Dude, the elk are so keen on just figuring out where people aren't, and that's where they're going to be. And like I think you said it so well, it's not like the furthest from the trailhead. It certainly is not, but it is usually the most difficult access to get there. And I don't know, man. Onyx needs to make a filter where you just click a button. It's like, okay, here's all the spots that are pain in the ass to get to. And that would light up the world. Mark Livesey was at your camp teaching that e-scouting stuff.
Yep.
He's taught a lot of people some really cool stuff. You don't have an advantage e-scouting anymore, I would say. Would you disagree with that?
No, there's a million YouTube videos you can watch and all that kind of stuff. So
But you definitely can't avoid not logging in and putting your time and trying to understand the terrain features as much as possible, where the bottlenecks are going to be, and try to like look through some crystal ball to understand what it's going to be like. But you know what? No matter what you do on a computer, it will never look the same when you get there. And that's a fact.
Yeah, for sure. I killed an antelope this year in August, or last year, in New Mexico. My hunt, I got it done on like day two. I had like 5 days to be there. And I was like, man, I'm already in New Mexico. And there's this unit that Troy drew a couple of years ago, but he couldn't go because he had to move to Montana that September.
Okay.
I was like, man, I got a couple of days. I'm going to drive up there and look at it. So I went up there for like a day and a half and hiked my balls off, just going all through it. Really helped. Found some really cool spots, cool basins, a lot of bull sign. And I'm hoping I draw that unit this year, hopefully. But like you're saying, like being able to get boots on the ground and go in there, I was able to see some trails and stuff that, you know, it may have taken me 2 days of hunting it to figure that stuff out, but now I already know it in advance.
What about this part of the conversation, Carter, where it's like, hey, you live in Virginia, you're a non-resident in 49 other states. What's your philosophy on trying to get an elk tag, or even strategy to, for that matter, of like, do you have like short-term, mid-term, long-term plans? Like, dude, it's hard to get an elk tag nowadays, and I'm not complaining about it, by the way.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny because like I'll have a lot of people here in Virginia who will talk about like, man, I want to do that, and I'll help anybody with applying for tags, and it blows some people's minds talking about the preference points and bonus points and the difference between squaring it and all that kind of stuff. So, but I've gotten pretty in depth, I feel like, as far as trying to build my plan out for, honestly, sheep, for elk, mule deer, all that kind of stuff. I've got some pretty long-term goals, obviously, in states like Utah and Arizona, Nevada. But I buy points in every state that I can, except for Washington. I need to look back into that. But I also apply for far-out lucky tags, like Virginia, we have elk. They give out 5 tags a year. Granted, those bulls are like 400 inches and they're massive. Same with Kentucky has a lot of elk. I put in for that. Pennsylvania, I put in for that. It'd be great to draw one of those tags. Save me a lot of driving.
Yeah, it would, man. You're spending a small fortune on tag. At least you're floating a lot of money out there and then still paying, you know, non-refundable fees.
Yeah.
How much capital does a guy need to be aggressive and put in for all these draws?
Calculated out not too long ago. I think to put in for not gonna say everything, but like 80-70% of the states to build points or to apply, you're gonna lose a little bit over $1,000. I think it's like $1,300. Like you're not gonna get back either in preference points. You know, states like Colorado, Utah, Arizona, where you have to buy a hunting license in order to even apply, you're gonna lose all that. And then you got states like New Mexico, obviously, where you got to pay that money up front, so you got to float some cash and hope you get drawn, or there's a pretty good chance you're just going to get it back anyways. So if you wanted to be really aggressive, you really need to have probably like $2,000 to $3,000 ready to float, knowing you're going to get most of that back probably.
Good old Wyoming's now holding on to your loot for 5 months.
Yeah. Yeah. I applied for Wyoming this year. I don't have enough points to draw it, but there's always that chance.
Yeah. You do have that random portion of the draw. And man, it is so scientific now with all these draws. Like, I for a while there, I was making content for the Elk Collective, and I was having to research so much before I'd make a video. It's like every year I would forget half the nuance that each state has, and I'd have to read the proclamation cover to cover. And you know, there are places like Hunt and Fool, they'll do your application for you. They're going to charge a fee per app, but they've been doing it for years, like decades, and they've been doing it for thousands and thousands of people. So it's like, if you're somebody who's busy and just doesn't have the time and you can afford an application service, that might be a plan, or even get their membership that allows you phone consultations. I think that's pretty unique in the space to have an actual phone conversation consultation going through your, essentially your Out West hunting portfolio and devising a plan versus just trying to wing it on your own. Like I do every year. And yeah. Have you put in for New Mexico yet?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm pretty much done with everything, I think, except for, I guess, Colorado's coming up, but I'm not going to put in for Colorado for a draw this year. That'll be my backup. And then the Idaho control draws, I'll put in for a couple things in there.
When is the draw deadline? Oh, it's March 24th. So I still got time. I haven't even put in for New Mexico yet. I do like putting in for New Mexico. I think a lot of you guys should, because they don't have a point system. It's purely pretty much random through and through. And I think the allocation, don't even quote me. I can't remember the allocation. I want to say it's
10,
like,
is it 10%? I think it's 10%.
No, it's not, because like the outfitter, you have an outfitter portion that takes up some of it. Like, so if you put in with an outfitter, you have a little bit more of a chance. It's kind of an incentive to hire an outfitter and keep those guys in business or what have you.
So my New Mexico tag this year, I did put in with an outfitter for one of the top units in the state. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. But I did that because I qualify for those mobility hunts.
Oh, talk to me.
It took me a while to do it, just because there's definitely people who have it a lot worse off than me. You know, obviously I killed an elk this year by myself. Like, I don't think I'm that crippled that I need help. But also looking at it, I had a friend who's from New Mexico who, she was talking to me about it. She was like, you need to do this. Like, not enough people do it. The hunts are once in a lifetime. Like, just do it once, get your trophy bull, and you'll be really grateful you did. So they have mobility impaired, which is for a couple of different species. I think all the species they have them for it. They have it for oryx on your sheep, antelope, mule deer, and then your elk too. The elk mobility hunts, most of them are in like the top three units in the state, and they're a October like 1st through 5th rifle hunt. And with the mobility stuff, it raises my odds from what would be like 0.9% in that unit to like 12% chance of drawing.
Damn.
So I was like, man, you know, I knew those outfitters and I knew they were pretty solid. Wasn't a bad price. I was like, if I can do this once and kill a mega for my shoulder mounted bull, you know, to have in the house one day, I'll try it and I'll get out of it. So that was my New Mexico plan for this year.
I'm into it. The other states that people probably, I mean, it's a moving target, right? Like, you got Colorado threatening every year to take away the over-the-counter opportunities. It's hard to argue when you look at the amount of non-residents hunting versus residents, you know? So I do feel for that situation. I usually don't speak up about kind of stuff like that, just because it's like, man, I'm not there. I don't have a say. But Montana's draw is definitely an interesting one as well. Kind of confusing, but there's a bonus point for the limited entry areas, but then there's a preference point to get the general tag, and you can buy a preference point at the time of the draw, which also makes it weird, but then you can't have more than 3 points going into the draw. You start over to zero. You get a preference for putting with an outfitter. Man, it changes so much, man. It wasn't that long ago where I could hunt Montana every year by buying a leftover general tag, where I would go to Idaho, kill an elk, go back to a gas station and buy a second tag and hunt Idaho. Those days are gone, and that's fine. Like, I'll just pivot like the rest of you. But I think Oregon gets overlooked because they do have west side over the counter. East side is now a draw, but you could still be getting like by a point in Oregon and then cash in on an east side tag. There's some good elk numbers in there. My state, you mentioned, is a great state where you can put in, but you're going to end up with an elk tag. So I want to warn you about that, man. Like, you can't put in for Washington. And Washington's got 400 inch bulls. Straight up, we do. But you can't put in for our draw without ending up with an elk tag, which kind of sucks, right? Like, I just want to put in and try to draw this tag. I don't want to end up with a east or west side tag. Mm. Well, that's
gotcha. How they roll. Saw like $600 or $700, whatever it is, kind of deal.
Yeah. But Washington does have that thing that Utah does too, where they have several limited entry units that you can hunt with a general tag, but you can only shoot a cow or a spike. And for a lot of noobs, that's a really good chance to just learn about elk, see elk, and potentially get a cow or a spike, you know, for your first elk, which is something certainly to be proud of. Utah has very similar things like that. Utah has over-the-counter tags, which is something that people don't think about, because Utah's limited entry tags are just so difficult to obtain. I'm at year 17 and I'm still behind the Point Creek, and, you know, I'm just kind of trying to be healthy, and maybe I'll hunt Utah when I'm in my 80s or 90s, finally draw out. But yeah, no, for real. And then, you know, I was going to tell you, the Nevada issues, maybe 30 something non-resident elk tags a year for archery across the state.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, the rifle tags are, yeah, it's pretty nuts.
So it's tough to play the game in Nevada, but, you know, and then did you put in for Arizona?
Yeah, a good friend of mine lives in Phoenix, and he elk hunts there. So he told me, probably going this is pretty, it's pretty cool, actually. He's a firefighter in Mesa, Arizona, which is like just east of Phoenix.
Yep.
And right when I got hurt, a good friend of mine was out there in Phoenix, or in Mesa, I'm sorry, working with their fire department, you know, trying to learn some new stuff. And it mentioned what had happened to me. And Mace is his name, is actually a one-legged firefighter out there as well.
Oh, okay.
So he actually reached out and ended up flying out to Virginia in November to meet with me for a couple of days. Just talk about stuff, like how he got through it.
Right.
How firefighting was different for him. And then he threw in on top of that, that he pretty much elk guides for all his family and friends in Arizona. Because even as a resident, he can't draw a tag to save his life.
Okay.
So he told me, he was like, here's a unit. Put in for it every year. One year you'll get lucky and we'll go kill a 400-inch bull together. So that's what I apply for every year. I think I've been applying there 5 years now. So maybe in another 10, I'll draw it.
Yeah, so you got your loyalty point now, which is an extra point.
Yep.
Which is good. Man, I'm excited for you. There's still some draws to put in for, some results to shake out, but you don't got an elk tag in your pocket at the moment, correct?
No, I got in the line at Idaho and picked up a muley tag in a unit that I wanted to hunt. So that was cool. One of those mid-October hunts. So it'll be fun. But the only elk tags left was like the panhandle. And I know there's elk there, like you've elk hunted there obviously before, but I wanted a couple of units a little bit different, like central, southern part of the state. So I'll log on there. When's the leftover or the return tags are coming up. I'll log on there soon and see what they got and maybe try to get an elk tag there. But yeah, this year, don't really have the best options just because of where my points are. Can't apply for, I could apply for Montana again, but if you buy a preference point in Montana and apply, you have 0% chance. If you apply with no points, you have like 30% chance, but then you can't buy a point later in the fall. So then you're just going to end up hoping again for that 30% chance. So this year in Montana, I'm just going to buy another point and then apply next year and then have like that 80% chance of drawing. So might end up in Colorado this year. We'll see. Hopefully not. Hey. Hopefully I get that. Your tag.
I just don't think you should take years off from elk hunting, man. It's just one of those things you got to have reps at it every year. Just take that same approach to Colorado where it's like, I'm not looking for the deepest, darkest hole. I'm looking for the nastiest place to get to. Doesn't have to be far from a road. And that's a huge takeaway on this pod today, guys. So appreciate you, your time. I got to run to a meeting. Where are you on Instagram?
Yeah.
What's your Instagram handle?
Carter, and it's __Lewis_.
Got it. I will put that in the show notes, guys. Follow along. Pretty inspiring, dude. I know I was inspired watching you work out, hence the Spirit of the Elk-Shaped Camp Award, and just staying in touch with you. And I'm so happy for your success, man.
No, I appreciate it. I appreciate everything I learned from you in camp. So it's been awesome.
Dude, let's do it again and reach out. We'll get you on the pod a year later and see how you did next year, this coming season, and what you're continuing to learn and evolve. So really respect what you got going on, and thanks for being a badass elk hunting firefighter, man. And shout out to everyone who is a firefighter. I got nothing but respect for what you do.
For sure. No, I appreciate it, Dan.
Awesome. All right, guys, you heard it here first. Separation is in the preparation. We'll catch you on the next one.
Guys, hope you enjoyed that one. Thanks for tuning in. Really appreciate your support. You do have a lot of options when it comes to podcasts. Thanks for choosing us. We do appreciate it. Shout out to all you hardworking people getting ready for elk season 2024. If there's anything I can do, always feel free to reach out. A couple of things I definitely think you could consider having in your arsenal. And these are the companies that I work with. And when you support them, you support me, and you know that I ain't kicking out any fluff. OnX Hunt, getting the elite membership, have access to all 50 states, constantly be e-scouting and prospecting where you're going to hunt in 2024, and to be able to download your offline maps to create hunt plans and to e-scout from your phone, e-scout from your desktop. OnX Hunt, man, it's where it's at. Vortex Optics out of Wisconsin. These are my people. This is what I'm running for elk season. No joke. I'm going to run the Viper 3000. That's the rangefinder. UHD 10x42s. That Razor Mini 58mm angled spotter. It weighs nothing. Their Summit Carbon 2 tripod on the side of my pack. If you are in the market for glass head over to eurooptic.com. The discount code is, I'm going to look it up for y'all. It is ELK10. That'll take 10% off. That's eurooptic.com. Discount code for Vortex Optics is ELK10, 10% off if you're doing something like that. Shout out to Peaks Equipment. They just came out with that new Solace sleeping bag. I haven't had an opportunity to fully test it in the backcountry, so I won't talk about good or bad about it. Yeah, I'm assuming it's going to be awesome, dude. It's got arm ports. I can drink coffee and stay in my sleeping bag, sold. But I do run the Solitude teepee. It looks like they're working on the last rendition of the stove. I'm excited about that. For the trekking poles, they have the Sissy Sticks, the Backcountry Elite Cork. It's awesome. And if you use trekking poles as much as me, that's what you're going to want to get. And the reason why I use trekking poles is that it just saves energy and allows me to just hunt longer and harder. Harder being the key point there. And for gators, the Stormcastle gators, all that stuff from Peaks, including the Duo headlamp, in my opinion, the best headlamp ever. And I'm not saying that just because I have to. I'm saying that because it is. It has a red light with three levels to it. It's got a white light with three levels to it. And then you can also make sure that it doesn't turn on in your backpack. Nothing is worse than digging out your headlamp only to find that it's been on all day while you were hunting and they have no battery left and you got a bull to break down. So I do run two headlamps always. I have a backup one. And so that one is, I put it in a position to where it won't turn on. So I hold down that button 4 seconds. It flashes twice at you. It's on lock. And then you can put it away. They're rechargeable USB-C. So I can use like dark energy to charge those back up. We'll do more of a gear dump type pod here coming up soon with bear season and kind of run through some of the changes we've made and what we've upgraded or what we are not going to upgrade, what's working, things like that. But the discount code is ElkShape 10% off at Peaks. Head over to their website. I got a link to them off my website if you're in the market. Buck Knives is coming out with some new drops any day now, March or April. I don't know when. What they're dropping is what I'm going to be running this year. It's kind of a new like economical rendition of the Packlight series. So what they're going to do is they have two sheaths that are put together that will hold your field knife, which you'll be able to do almost anything and everything with that. And then a cape knife. I don't always cape animals out, but I bust that cape out when I'm working around the neck and stuff like that, the thickest hide, or if I'm doing anything really technical, maybe I'm peeling the hide off the skull or whatever. And so the caper, the field in a combo, and then just get yourself like a little flat stone or Buck makes really cool, like lightweight sharpening. I'm here to tell you, fix knives, man. Buck doesn't do it like crazy marketing. You're not going to, but they've been around since 1902. It's made here in the States. In fact, it's made 15 minutes from my house in Post Falls, Idaho. So that's what's dropping soon. And then they have these Alpha series that are coming out and just be on the lookout. These are like the knives that you're going to buy and you're going to pass down to the next generation. It'll stay in the family. I love the history of Buck Knives. Good people, great brand, strong brand, and super proud to work with them. Wilderness Athlete has a couple things I think you should be taking. One is the good stuff. It's got all the stuff in one packet, so it's super easy to just not forget. When you have like 7 pill bottles to try to remember to take every day, you're not going to remember. At least I don't. So in the good stuff, and that's all I'm going to talk about, they have a lot of other products, you know, creatine, daily strength, all that kind of stuff for post-workout, pre-workout, branch chains. But the good stuff, we're talking 2 tabs of fish oil, get your omegas. It's got your 3 multivitamins you can take all at once or spread out throughout the day. I just take it all at once. And then a probiotic. Get that in there and help your blood work out. If you haven't listened to our blood work podcast, go back and listen to it. Basically, that stuff's been helping me get all the things I need that I don't get from food. And speaking of food, coming soon to the ElkShape training channel, we are doing a full day of eating. I've been asked to do that for years and I haven't done that. We finally did it. And so it's kind of cool to see what we eat and what that breaks down to protein, carb, fat, total grams, total cows, and macro percentages and meal timing. That's going to be coming soon. We're finishing up the final edits on that. Speaking of drops in the spring, Crispy's going to come out with a Laponia 3, a couple little tweaks. That's going to be my number one. They also have the Laponia Light. That's going to be like my new like stocking boot. I'm really excited to try that one out. And I have like this new little sneaky boot that I'm like really digging. It is the new to me. It's the Summit 2. It's really good price. It's one step down from the Colorado on the Flex rating scale. So the Colorado's around a 4. This is just like the Colorado, but it's the Summit 2. It's at a 3. It's kind of that sweet spot, not super stiff, but it's just a good synthetic. That's going to be a good hunting boot for a lot of your out west adventures. And probably the price is right. The boot I ran probably the most last year was the Brickstall Mountain GTX. And again, I've said that thing is an all mountain boot. It's awesome. Just giving you some options to look at as you get. Always have two pairs of boots, in my opinion, because if you get one pair of boots just soaking wet and you don't have a boot dryer, and man, putting on wet boots suck. Trust me. I've done it so many times. I mean, I grew up hunting North Idaho jungle. So wet feet suck. And I also have this new backcountry, I forgot the brand name, but this little plug-in to my USB dark energy bank where it's a little backcountry boot dryer. I'm going to try that out this spring, and I'm going to let y'all know if it's awesome. I think it is going to be awesome. So Stealth Cam came out with some new drops too in 2024. I haven't gone through them yet. I'm going to do a review on them soon. I have a lot of trail cameras to go get. A lot of them are probably buried in snow. That's the cool thing about Stealth, man. I leave those DS4Ks out year round, and they'll just go to sleep in the winter and then they wake back up, and I'm getting animals as they come back up the mountain in the spring. And these cameras are literally buried in snow and still working. They're the most reliable, best 4K footage out there. I tried several brands. I even ran one brand and worked with them for a year, and it was just a nightmare. I'm not going to say the name of them, but just Stealth Cam, the most reliable one. That's my go-to. If you guys haven't had a chance to check out Elk Shape Gear YouTube channel, I just did a full video because I couldn't find one. There probably is one out now, but I couldn't find a video out there showing how to put an older pack on the new ARC frame. So I went and filmed myself setting up the ARC frame, getting it fit for me, and then putting the bed limb on. It's kind of a 20-minute video, but we got really good camera angles on purpose so you could see up close how to do that. And check that video out if you haven't. It's just going to be up there as an asset for you guys if you get into the position. The ARC is definitely not cheap. It's a $500 investment, but I think that's going to last you a lifetime. And I think the new shoulder straps, belt, lumbar pad, denser foam, it's going to be a better ride. It's going to last longer. And fire stuff's already lasting a long time, so could be a buy once, cry once situation. The bed limb or the hood limb is generally what I go to, but I am eyeing their new ultra light. I don't think you're supposed to say ultra light, but it's their KU. It's a 4300 with no really craziness, just super simple, super streamlined for lightweight hunting. I'm going to be looking into that as well. Speaking of YouTube, recently did a new to me arrow build. I used the Mod Saw. I have no relationship with those guys. They sent me one to try and test. I was impressed. It definitely has a 3D printing vibe on some of the components, but for someone looking to get their own saw, the price is right, man. And it does three things. One, it cuts arrows really well, seriously. And number two, it's got a way for you to square off your arrows in the same system. And lastly, it's got a way for you to spin test your arrows to make sure your components and eliminate wobble. So check out that latest drop on YouTube. I think it was Thursday we dropped that video, and it's just me building X10s with the new Easton components with that mod saw. Everything was new to me, and it was a fun arrow build. That doesn't mean that's the arrow I'm going to use. Right now, if you were to put me on the spotlight, I would say I am practicing with Easton Axis long range 4mm match grades that weigh 447. And then I'm going to hunt with the X10s that weigh the exact same with a different component. They are grouping so tight at long distances, and I've broadhead tested them. And so right now it is snowing as I'm recording this, and I have a mountain lion outfitter that is supposed to call me next time we get a good snow at a moment's notice, and I'm going to go mountain lion hunting. I don't know if that's going to happen, but literally my bags are packed, and in my quiver is X10s, and I have two broadheads in that quiver. I have Iron Will single bevel solid 125s to the left, and then I have the Slick Trick Magnum SS. I've been shooting that one a lot at long distance, and it's been flying really, really well with my setup. So hopefully I get a chance to shoot a mountain lion or a bear with that Magnum. And then I always just have Iron Wheels in there just because I know that's what's up. If you've seen some of my recent content on Instagram, a lot of guys are like, what shirt are you wearing? That is a Merino top from Marsupial. It's their sun shirt, I believe. The most comfortable shirt ever. That's what I'm wearing on some of the videos recently. Just got it. Love it. It's camera guy Jeff has been coveting it. I only got one. Sorry, Jeff, I didn't get you one, but we'll get you one. It's awesome. Check it out. So this spring bear, I will get a ton of bear footage. And how I do that is I have that 58 millimeter spotter from Vortex, and then I have MagView S1 on the top. So I have a cover for it. I flip it open, magnet on my phone, boop, pop on, and I can digiscope vertically or horizontally. I can use all three lenses of my iPhone 14. And to me, that's a great solution. They also make the B1 for your binoculars. So if you have your binoculars on attached to like a tripod, which I'll do a ton of that while bear hunting from a master vantage, you can also slap a magnet on your binoculars and get awesome. It's made in America, lifetime warranty. Discount code Oakshape takes 10% off. Let me just run through some discount codes. These are in the show notes as well. Canvas cutter, 10% off. The code is Oakshape. Get the Dominator with the poles. That is like my favorite sleep system if I'm not hopping in a rooftop tent. I'm throwing that on the ground and crashing when elk hunting. That goes with me on all elk hunts. Anything from blackobus.com, discount code Elkshape, 10% off most SKUs. So if you're buying, I mean, Black Obus has everything under the sun. So if you're going to buy from them, throw that discount code in there, save yourself some loot. Born Primitive Outdoor, we talked about them just a couple minutes ago, about their layering system. We'll do a full video on our layering system soon. 10% off discount code is Elkshape. Vortex Wear for date night, for scouting, for looking cool. They make great clothing. Discount code Elkshape, 20% off Vortex Wear. Again, Wilderness Athlete, discount code Elkshape, 20% off. Stealth Cam, 10% off cellular is Elkshape. Sheep Feet, 10% off code Elkshape. That's a must, not a should. Believe me, I was a naysayer. It goes in all my boots. It will make a difference, and it will make your feet last longer, and you will be able to hunt better. The end. For all my fitness friends out there working on your shoulders or your hips, Crossover Symmetry, discount code Elkshape, 20% off. If you don't have a med kit in your backpack, look at My Medic. The discount code is Elkshape. It will take 15% off. Most of us at Elkshape Squad, we run the MyFac. We throw it in there, or the MyFac Mini, or a Sidekick, and then open that bad boy up, go through it, make sure you know what everything is in there. There'll be instructions as well, and just familiarize with everything, and then tell your hunting partner where your medic kit is, and then have them tell you where their med kit is, just to be safe. I hunt with a paramedic, firefighter, Tyler, and then I hunt with Jeff, who's got his CPR card, but we all know where our med kits are, and we just don't, I mean, before you go buy something super fancy and gear related, get your med kit first. I don't talk about it enough. I might have to bring somebody from My Medic on just to kind of go through it. It's just to have a long form resource for you to know like what's in the kit, and we could do that as well. But I definitely want you to have your own first aid kit, build it yourself, make sure there's a tourniquet in there. And make sure you know how to use everything in there. Like as a firefighter, when I was doing that, like part of your job was knowing where everything is on the truck, including all the meta stuff, and knowing where to get anything and everything. I was only an EMT, but my job was to know where everything is and how everything worked. And I think that's your job just for safety, because there's people who depend on you while you're hunting for you to come back home safely. For your backcountry energy needs, we're running the Poseidon. That's from Dark Energy. They came out with a newer one. I mean, it's waterproof, dustproof. You can get 3 charges on your cell phone at least. They also have a Spectre now, which is like a real fold-up portable solar panel that can recharge your juice, if you will. We usually carry, honestly, like I have 2 or 3 Poseidons in my backpack because we have mics to charge. DSLR batteries to charge for cameras. Plus I use my phone on Onyx nonstop, and there's just a lot of things to charge up, including my headlamps. So that's what I use in the backcountry. And then a lot of times I'll have a Poseidon back at the base camp with another Spectre recharging out in the sun while I'm hunting. So I'm kind of, if I ever make it back to the truck, I'm always swapping out Poseidons. That's what we run. Discount code Elkshape, give you free shipping. Guys, thanks for listening to today, man. Hopefully we talked about some stuff that inspires you. Hopefully we talked about some stuff gear-wise that got you thinking. It's that time of year where we start really kind of combing through, auditing what we have, what we can keep, what we need to upgrade. And we're just trying to make it so you have a better experience in the backcountry. And I'm just trying to make sure that you're fit and prepared for the backcountry. If you're not fit, head over to Elk Shape Training. It's on elkshape.com and get on the program, man. Right now we have over 300 members working hard, like-minded people getting ready for elk season. And I'll be honest, man, the training is insane. It's awesome. You can scale it up or down. We're in the middle of energy system development season. So at the end of every workout, there's ESD component where you're working on intervals that are surgical to basically bolster your VO2 max and to make sure that you have the biggest, strongest engine for all your hunting adventures. Head over to elkshape.com, check out Elk Shape Training, and remember, separation is in the preparation. We'll catch you on the next one.